Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour each weekday afternoon. We're taking your calls, and if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, this is one place where you can call to ask and we'll discuss them together. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737 if you'd like to call. Our first caller today is Jordan calling from Jacksonville, Florida. Jordan, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I had a question about Romans 10:9. I was reading in a book by Nabil Qureshi on No God But One, where he was talking about this passage and saying that Lord there, in its proper context, is saying basically God. He uses the verse 13 as an example where it quotes Joel chapter 2. It says, "All who call on the name of the Lord shall be saved." And he's saying that the word for Lord there in Hebrew is Yahweh. So he's suggesting that Paul is suggesting that you need to confess that Jesus is God in order to be saved. He doesn't outright say that that's necessary for salvation, but that seems to be what he's hinting at. And I was wondering what you thought about that.
Well, he's right about verse 11, which is, of course, a quotation from Joel, where it says, "Whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord," verse 13, "whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be saved." That's Joel 2:32. The word Lord there in Joel is Yahweh. And in the Greek, the word that Paul uses is kurios, which is an ordinary word for Lord or master. And the problem with figuring out whether Paul means by the use of the word kurios, Yahweh, in any given instance, is that the word is a generic word for Lord, but it's also a word that was used in the Septuagint to translate the name Yahweh. So when the Hebrew Yahweh, the Hebrew scriptures were translated into Greek, the Greek translators used the word kurios to translate Yahweh, which means that when the New Testament writers quote the Old Testament, and they usually quote from the Septuagint, you find the word kurios in the quotation in Greek, which was Yahweh in the original. The problem is that the word Lord doesn't always mean Yahweh, and the use of the word kurios to translate Yahweh confuses things a little bit. Because, of course, when Christians say Jesus is Lord, they might mean that that he is Yahweh, because that would be the way many Christians would express their belief. But the word Lord also can just mean master. It's a little bit like the word Adonai in the Old Testament in the Hebrew. Adonai means Lord or master, but it's also sometimes used of God. God is sometimes called a master or Lord. And therefore, you know, the word Adonai, you have to take it really case by case in context. Is this talking about God, the Adonai, or some other Adonai? After all, the word kurios in Greek and the word Adonai in Hebrew not only mean Lord and Master, they can also just mean Sir, just be a term of respect spoken to a man, or we might have it translated my Lord, which is often spoken to an individual, a man. So the book that you're reading, or the author that you're mentioning, he has a case, but it's not an airtight case. It's true that Paul does quote from Joel, where the word kurios is Yahweh. And he does so just three verses after verse 10, where he says, or verse 9, where he says, "Whosoever shall, if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is kurios, or Lord, and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you'll be saved." Well, this could be Paul saying you have to say that Jesus is Yahweh, but it's not that clear. And it seems like if Paul was trying to say that you must confess Jesus to be deity or God, he could have used a word less ambiguous. He could have used the Greek word theos, which means God. He could have said, "If you will confess with your mouth that Jesus is God." Well, of course, to the Christian, there's only one God, and that's Yahweh, so that would be unambiguous. But when he says, "Confess that Jesus is Lord," well, Lord means master or owner, but it sometimes can refer to God also. But I think Paul makes it rather ambiguous there, too much so, for us to be certain about that meaning.
Okay, so for him, I don't know if you know much about him, he comes from a Muslim background, and realizing that Jesus was God was, or that Jesus at least claimed to be God, was pretty foundational in his faith. And also for him and pretty much all Muslims, the concept of Jesus being God is by far the biggest stumbling block to accepting Christianity. So would you say that that's something that should be kind of a prerequisite for them to understand that Jesus is God, or is that something that could be part of discipleship? What would you think?
Well, I think that people, as they grow in their Christian faith, need to come to the understanding that Jesus is the incarnate God, that he is God in the flesh. And I think that Christians generally do learn that as they study the scriptures. But a person who first becomes a believer may or may not fully understand the deity of Christ. For example, the apostles, I don't think, understood the deity of Christ when they first became believers in Jesus. When they first became followers and disciples of Jesus, I don't think they understood that he was God. I think Jews, just like Muslims, would have had exactly the same problem. Both the Jews and the Muslims believe there's only one God, and he's not a man. And therefore, to say that Jesus is God would be just as great a difficulty for a Jew as for a Muslim. It wouldn't be difficult for a Roman or a Greek who believed in many gods. Jesus could be just another one of those. But to the Muslim or to the Jew, who are very staunchly monotheistic, to say Jesus is God is a tremendous stumbling block. And I guess the question is, did the apostles, when they left their nets, did they know that Jesus was God? And when they became disciples of his, I don't think they did, but they came to know it later on. And so I think probably some people are followers of Christ who have not yet quite understood that concept.
Okay. I appreciate it, Steve.
All right, Jordan. I appreciate your call.
All right.
God bless you. All right. Let's talk to Doug from San Rafael, California. Doug, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Okay. So I got a question. Have you ever heard of aliens being demonic beings?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean, aliens being demonic beings. Do you mean that when people have seen UFOs? When you say this, are you referring to UFOs that Christians would identify those as demonic beings? Is that what you're asking?
No. I'm a new Christian because I was just attacked by Satan in February. It's a long story, and it would take way too long to get into, but it has to do with aliens. So I was just wondering if anyone's ever heard of aliens being demonic beings, because the fact is that I was abducted in 1976, and now they've come back and attacked me.
And how did you respond to that attack?
Well, it was shocking. So I never believed in religion, really, because of being abducted. I didn't really know how anything fit together or how anything worked. And so I just kind of left it open, and I've lived a very sinful life. Now that I've started to read the Bible and get in and research my life, it's like wow, it's unbelievable. So I've repented my sins. I'm getting baptized on the 9th.
Good. Well, let me just say, I think most evangelical Christians have heard the theory that that alien encounters are demonic. And I think it probably could be true. I've never had an alien encounter, so I've never been able to test the theory. But it does seem like lots of people who have had alien encounters or claim to have them are people who've also had other kind of involvement in the occult or in the demonic. And there are many Christians who take the position that those who have been abducted or who have had encounters with demons or simply see UFOs may be encountering something that is demonic. Again, I have no experience with such things, so I don't really know.
Right. I mean, you know, not too many people have had experiences like this.
Well, when you are attacked by these, how do you respond as a Christian?
Well, now I'm following the word of the Bible and Jesus.
Right,
but
what happened? So, could you tell me just what happened? They came back and they attacked you, and what did you do?
Well, see, so in 1976, all I remembered was I woke up on a spaceship with some guy, with one of them doing some work on my stomach, and I said, and it really hurt bad. I'm like, why are you doing this to me? And then I blacked out. And there was, like I said, it's a long story. I was in Marcy, Idaho. I was in the Job Corps, and some guy walked in and said, I see some flying saucers. So we all walked up this hill, and we saw them. And the next thing, you know, we know is there's a flash of light over our heads, and we all went running back into our dorms. The next day, I found some markings on my stomach, and I didn't know how they got there, so I just blew it off. And then later on in the 80s, I started having memories of being on this spaceship, and then I, you know, didn't think, you know, what am I going to do about it? And,
yeah. Well,
now,
let me just say this.
February,
Doug,
let me
jump in here, Doug, because like you said, it is a long story and probably take too long to go into all of it. All I can say is I don't have any firsthand knowledge of alien encounters. I've heard stories like yours before. I don't know what I think about them, but I guess what I think about them doesn't matter that much. I would say that if I were to encounter beings that appeared to be aliens from another planet, I would certainly, until I found out otherwise, I would treat them as if they may be demonic. And I would command them to be gone in the name of Jesus Christ. And if they are demonic, I believe they would be gone.
Yeah, because so when this happened to me, I mean,
I'm sorry, we can't hear the whole story, but I'm just saying that is how I would deal with it. And you asked me if I've heard of aliens being demons. I have definitely heard that theory before.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. So I'm on the right track.
Well, I think there's a good chance that that's how you're to identify it. But are you in fellowship with other Christians?
Yes, I'm just, my brother was heavily into worship, and so I instantly contacted him, and he got me into his church, and I've been talking to people and going through things,
okay,
and reading the Bible. And
well, if you continue to have these kinds of encounters, you definitely bring them up to the Christians that you're in fellowship with, and seek their assistance and their prayer.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Thank you.
I appreciate your call. God bless you, Doug.
Have a good day. Bye.
You too. Bye now. All right. We're going to talk next to Mark from Bellingham, Washington. Mark, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Thanks for taking my call, Steve. I've gone to a couple of your meetings before when you come up to Washington. And, you know, I've met you before, and you seem like a good Christian guy, and I've listened to you, me and my wife and stuff, but, you know, I just got a problem that sometimes, you know, most of the time this is what you say. You say, well, you know, this is not a political show, and I don't, you know, it's a Bible answer type, you know, biblical questions and stuff like that. And that's what I think you should stick with, Steve, because it's been a while it's been about a couple of weeks ago. I just hadn't had time to get to calling, to call to you to react to what you said about, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago. You probably remember it because you don't have many political questions that come across, but somebody calls and you always say that you're not a fan of Trump but this is what you said. When somebody called in about the birth certificate of the president, you said, well, and I think you thought it was a really definite, I mean, it was a really clear-cut answer that you gave, like it was, you know, this just settles the whole deal. It was, like, pretty smart. but I don't think it missed the point totally.
Could you tell me what was said?
Okay. Yeah, well, this is what you said. I'm not talking about what your caller said.
Could you tell me what you heard me say? Yeah.
Okay, this is what you said. Nobody knows. You said all Trump's been saying is that he doesn't know where he was born.
Yeah.
You remember saying that?
Yeah, that's what I heard him say. He said that he didn't know where the president was born. Yeah.
Okay. And then you said, you added this in there. You said, well, nobody knows where anybody's born, which is true. If I go in the store and I walk by somebody, I don't know where the cashier or whoever. I don't know where anybody's born, right? That sounds good, what you said, right? However, this is the whole point. No one has ever questioned the president of the United States' birthplace. And so that's the big difference, and that's the gap. And that's what Trump has been doing. He was the leader of that movement. And it's offensive to me as a black man. And like I said, I like the show.
Hey, Mark, I'm glad you're on. I'm glad you called, because you said it's offensive to you as a black man. And you can maybe clear something up for me here. I keep hearing, you know, people on the radio and on news saying that this birther question is a racist issue. Now, to my mind, where a man is born has nothing to do with his race. So how is this a racist question? And if someone was questioning whether Ted Cruz was or Marco Rubio or someone was eligible to be president because there are some circumstances of his birth that were unclear, no one would call that racist. But if there were things unclear about President Obama's birth, then why is that called racist? I mean, the real issue here, and I'm not, you're the one who raised the political question. I don't raise political questions here, but some do. But the point is here, I don't see anything racist about it. It may be that Donald Trump had no good reason to be suspicious, although he wasn't the one who originated, as you probably know. It was Sidney Blumenthal who was Clinton's friend during her campaign against Clinton, against Obama. It was Sidney Blumenthal that first floated the idea that Clinton was Obama was born in Kenya. It was not true, apparently, and there are birth certificates to show it was not true. But it was first floated by the Clinton camp, and then apparently Trump, not knowing whether it was true or not, picked it up and ran with it, and kept asking for the birth certificate. Now, to me, I'm not a Trump fan. But I would say, if somebody asked me where the president was born, I would say, I don't know. And especially if he has failed to produce a birth certificate when he was asked, I'd say, I really don't know. Now, once a birth certificate emerged, it seems like that would end the question. And it didn't for Trump, perhaps, but it should. But the point is, if the president has been asked to show a birth certificate many times, and for some reason he chooses not to do so, and the Democratic nominee against him, or the Democratic person running against him, Hillary Clinton's camp, says he wasn't born in America, then for Trump, who's, you know, hears that, for him to say, I don't know where he was born. I don't really understand how a man could be faulted for saying he didn't know. But more than that, I really don't understand how anyone can say it's racist. What does this have to do with race? To say, I don't think this man was born in this country. Yeah.
Are you ready for an answer?
Sure. I want one. Yeah.
Okay. Now, first of all, I mean, it's like I just said something and you just blew away everything I said. I said, because here's the point about the racist point, and then I'll get to your other, I think you made another point. Okay, here's how it's racist, okay? Because President Obama is an American citizen. Okay, and
well, that was what was at issue.
Why was that at issue?
Well, you didn't hear me. There was a question raised on the Democrat side that he might not have been born in the United States. Okay.
Okay.
And that is one of the constitutional requirements for someone being president. So in other words, Mr. Trump heard that and he didn't know any better, so he said he didn't know. How is that racist?
That's what you heard. That's what you heard. Trump and his camp. Painted has. That's
no,
a lie also.
No, that's not a lie. Actually, that's confirmed.
Okay,
that was confirmed in the liberal media.
You have my email, Steve. I would like you to email me the quote or the link that shows Sidney Blumenthal or whoever he says that started it.
Hold on, Mark. Excuse me. I don't have that quote, and I'm not looking for it. Both the liberal and the conservative press have both said that it was Sidney Blumenthal. Pardon?
You repeated it, though.
You're right. I repeat a lot of things I hear on the news.
Okay, but I'm just saying it's not true. It's a lie, like Trump does. Trump lies all the time.
Okay, but Mark, hang on. Hey, calm down. Mark, calm down, please. Why is it a lie? How do you know it's a lie that Sidney Blumenthal said that first?
Because I did the research, and I can't find Sidney Blumenthal saying it. If you can do a more extensive research on
okay,
it,
well, Mark, hang on a minute.
Then it's to me.
Mark, you just told me when you opened up this conversation that you don't want me talking about politics, but you're kind of forcing us to discuss this matter. Let's go back to what's really going on here. All I said was that if Mr. Trump says he doesn't know where the president was born, I don't really see how that's a racist statement. Mark, I don't know where you were born, but that's not a racist statement. Just because I'm a white man and you're a black man, that doesn't mean I'm a racist. Just because I don't know where you're born, you haven't told me where you're born.
I keep telling you the reason why it's racist, because President Obama is an American citizen. He has no, you have no right to pull him over and to single him out. Why? Because he's the first black president. Now you're going to say, hey, you wasn't born here. You're really not an American, because that's the reason why it's racist, because no other president has ever been asked to show their papers. So why are you going to single out this black man to ask him to show his papers?
I think the reason they wanted to, there was some question, is because his father was not an American citizen, and because it was not, and because Obama's grandmother had said she had been present at his birth in Kenya, and because it was known that he was raised in Indonesia and other places.
Okay.
So I think there were some questions about where he was born, and it's a very simple matter. It's a very simple matter, Mark, to say, yes, I was born in America, and here's. We can't both talk at the same time, so I have to do a little bit of the talking. This is, after all, you did call to talk to me and to hear from me, I think. If there's some question about where a man was born, I don't care who he is, what race he is, it doesn't matter. If he's president or if he's running for president, he needs to be able to demonstrate that he was born in America. Now, that apparently was possible to do from the beginning, because the birth certificate eventually emerged. But for some very long period of time, Mr. Obama chose not to produce the birth certificate, which is what itself, I think, tended to raise the birther question. If he's got a birth certificate, why doesn't he show it? It's not really, I mean, when someone who has not seen the birth certificate because it's been hidden from everybody says, I honestly don't know where he was born, that's not really a racist statement. It's not even an anti-Obama statement. It's just saying, I can't answer for Obama. Let him answer for it. I don't know where he was born.
Okay.
I appreciate your call. Okay, Mark. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. No. I'm not done.
Well, you might be. You said I have your. I have your email.
I hope you answered your question about why black people. And I'm not speaking for all black people. Of course not. But I'm just saying, why do you? You said, well, why do you seem as racist? Now, I wanted to get to the point that you just raised. You said, well, we wanted to know where he was raised. I'm going to show you the immigration law in our country goes like this.
No, Mark, this is not a political show. Listen, you can call Michael Medved or somebody else like that, or Rush Limbaugh, if you want to talk politics. Like you said, this is not a political show.
Okay,
you were taking me to task about something I had said, and what I had said was an extremely innocuous statement. I said that I don't know why people can fault Mr. Trump if he says he doesn't know where someone was born. Okay. Now, if you found that to be a racist statement, I didn't say anything about races at all. And neither did Mr. Trump, actually, as far as I know. And I'm not saying that Trump isn't a racist. Maybe he is. I'm not defending Trump. I'm simply making the observation that for a man who doesn't know something, to say that he doesn't know it is not a racist thing to do, even if the person that he doesn't know something about happens to be of a different race. I think you need to pull back a little bit and look at a statement, say, what in the world does a statement like that have to do with racism? It has nothing to do with racism. There were questions raised about Ted Cruz, I believe it was, or Rubio. Was it Rubio or Cruz? I think it was Cruz, wasn't it? About his citizenship or his eligibility when he was running. But nobody said, what a racist thing to do. He's Hispanic. You know, they must be doing this because he's Hispanic. No, they were probably doing it because they were his political opponents and because there was some reason to raise questions. You know, if you raise questions about where I was raised, I won't call you a racist. I might, well, you know what I would do? I would show you my birth certificate, like if it was important. And so I don't really understand your position here. But you did say that I have your email. I'm not sure why you think I have your email. I'm not even sure what your name is, apart from you being Mark in Bellingham. But if you want to send me your email, feel free to do that. Then I will have it. But I'll let you have the last word if it's brief. Go ahead.
Okay. Steve, this is all I wanted to say. Is that, and I love you, Steve, man. You're a good Christian guy. I would never, ever, I would defend you. And I don't know you.
I don't need the flattery. Just finish up your statement, and we'll go on to another call. Yeah, we got our lines full.
What I'm saying is that when you say there was a question about where he was born, right? The immigration law in our country goes like this. He was born by an American woman. His mother was a white woman from America. Right, and wherever she's born in the continent, in the universe, her baby would be an American. Now that's the way that's the way our immigration law works. So either way it goes, there was no legible reason or legitimate reason to ever question his birth.
The thing you have to realize is it's more than whether a person is a citizen. There are many people who were born in other countries who have become American citizens. So to be president, you don't only have to be American citizen. You have to have certain circumstances of birth that do not apply to all American citizens. I'm not a constitutional scholar, and I don't even care. I don't care where Obama was born. I don't care where Trump was born. I don't care about any of these things. But you seem to care a great deal about it. And, you know, if you're striving to prove to us that Obama was born in this country, I think that's a debate for a couple of years ago. I think that's been established already. He was born in this country where there's a birth certificate, and I don't really see why you'd want to be beating that particular dead horse. But I appreciate your call. Okay, let's talk next to Lee from Nashville, Tennessee. Lee, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. Hello, Lee? Well, maybe Lee isn't there.
Hello?
Lee?
Hello, yes, sir.
Yes, you're on the air.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you if you talk. Go ahead. Yes, please talk.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm calling to ask, how does one donate to you personally rather than just the radio time?
Well, they do that simply by donating to me personally. In other words, if they want me to have a gift, they make a check out to me. If a check is made out to the Narrow Path, it will go toward buying airtime, and I will not get one penny of it, and I don't want one penny of it. But if people want to support my family and my needs, they write checks out to me personally.
Okay, so just send it to the P.O. box that's on the website?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Well, thank you, brother. God bless you.
Okay, thanks for your call.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, let's talk next to Scott from Roseville, and we have lines open for you. At least one line open. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Scott, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. My question today is scriptural foundation on what apparently works just simply when the flesh turns on you, yourself, where you've been a bad boy, that kind of thing. And you're turning from God, and God wants you back. And you cry out, you know, Jesus, help me. Simplest prayer ever. It's helped me on so many occasions. And then there were other times when it seemed like the whole world was attacking me because Satan had at me. Your alien abduction color
and so do you have a question?
Other politically binded colors. My question is, there's power in the name of Christ, and with your faith that he is Lord, I've been saved immediately in situations where I was just as victimized as if abducted.
Okay,
but I did have demonic experiences, and just simply calling on the name of Jesus, the simplest prayer to resolve
Scott,
the issue.
Scott, you began by saying my question is, and I haven't heard a question yet. Do you have a question for me?
My question is, what scriptural foundation did Dr. Charles Stanley have to say the simplest prayer is just simply say, Jesus, help me?
Well, I think probably he could go by that scripture that was mentioned by an earlier caller. It's in Joel chapter 2 and verse 32, and it's quoted by Paul in Romans 10, 13. And there it says that whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be saved. So that's probably, I would think that's probably the scriptural foundation for Charles Stanley's remark. I didn't hear Charles Stanley's remark, but that would be no doubt this passage he had in mind. Everett from San Pablo, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you, Steve. My delight. I would like to say, I listened to the other caller that called in about Obama or what have you. I'm an African-American man myself, and I wouldn't put too much stock in that myself. I didn't look at it as a racial issue because there were some concerns about whether or not he was born U.S. or what have you, and I don't think I would want to push that agenda so much so because I do see that your commitment and dedication is to answer biblical questions and stay within the context of Scripture or what have you. So I appreciate how you handled the matter and the spirit in which you address the matter. I want to thank you, and I support you, and I thank God for your ministry, Steve. In conjunction with that, I have a question.
Okay.
In Matthew 21, Jesus talked about, he had cursed the fig tree, it withered away, and then he mentioned about if you have faith, not only will you be able to do what I've done unto this fig tree, but you'll be able to say unto this mountain, be removed, and it shall be removed. Can you give us some contextual understanding of that, about when he says this mountain, having that kind of faith, and all things whatsoever you ask in prayer, believing you shall receive? Could you give us an understanding? Because I was formerly years ago in the Word of Faith movement, and they would, you know, take this text and talk about speaking things into existence and, you know, moving poverty, moving disease, and things of that nature. Could you give us some contextual understanding of this particular text?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. Obviously, when Jesus cursed the fig tree, this has some kind of symbolic meaning. And when Jesus explained this business about having faith, it was in his explanation to his disciples of this cursing of the fig tree. Now, most scholars agree that when Jesus said to the fig tree, let no man ever eat fruit from you again, that he was referring to the fact that Israel had been visited by Christ and no fruit was found being produced, not the kind of fruit that God was looking for from that nation. Now, by the way, the fruit he was looking for was righteousness and justice. According to Isaiah 5:7, the fruit that God wished for Israel to produce was righteousness and justice. And just like the fig tree that didn't have any fruit, Israel didn't have any fruit. Now, it's not as if Israel hadn't had a lot of chances, because they had hundreds of years with much cultivation from God to get them to produce the fruit he was looking for, and they just kept being stubborn and obstinate, and they didn't do it. So he finally said, okay, it's not going to happen. No one will ever eat fruit from you again. And the tree withered up. Now, I think most understand this to mean, and I do, that Jesus was telling Israel, like this fig tree, you've had your chance, and you haven't borne fruit, and so you're done. This is the end of your career. You're not going to be ever producing fruit anytime in the future. No one will ever eat fruit from you again. And Israel was going to wither up. And, of course, this occurred within that generation when the nation of Israel was destroyed. The temple was destroyed. It's never been rebuilt. The end of Judaism came within 40 years of that time. And Jesus even said a few chapters later that this will all happen in this generation. Now, when he's describing that to the disciples, they pointed out the fig tree withering up. Jesus made this statement about faith and about speaking to this mountain. He said in verse 20, it says, now when the disciples saw the tree withered up, they marveled, saying, how did the fig tree wither away so soon? And Jesus cryptically, as he often answers, not directly, said, assuredly I say to you, if you have faith and do not doubt, you will not only do what was done to this fig tree, but also you, if you say to this mountain, be removed and be cast into the sea, it will be done. And all things whatsoever you ask in prayer, believing you will receive. Now, this mountain would refer not to the mountain that they were at that very moment ascending, which was Mount Zion, which is where Jerusalem sat. They were ascending on their way to Jerusalem. So Mount Zion was essentially, as you probably know in Scripture, almost a synonym for Jerusalem. And when he said, you can say to this mountain, be plucked up and cast into the sea, I think he was speaking symbolically. And the symbolism, I think, is this. In prophetic language of the Bible, the sea represents the Gentile nations. A mountain often represents a government in the biblical imagery of the prophets. But in this particular case, it was the government or the nation of Israel governed in Jerusalem there at Mount Zion. And for him to say, you can pray and this mountain, well, you can speak to it, and this mountain will be plucked up and thrown into the sea. That is, that the Jewish nation will be dispersed into the Gentile world. And this is agreeable with what the fig tree withering meant. It's another image similar in meaning to the fig tree. The fig tree Israel is no longer going to have a career of fruit bearing. Instead, it's going to be dissolved. It's going to be cast off into the nations. And that, of course, is exactly what did happen. Now, what's interesting is in Revelation chapter 8, when we see the seven trumpets sound, the first trumpet sounds, the second trumpet sounds in verse 8, it says, then the second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea. So here we see a mountain being plucked up and thrown into the sea, and it happens to be on fire. Of course, my understanding of Revelation is different than that of many people. I believe Revelation is primarily about the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. And I think this image of the mountain being thrown into the sea echoes what Jesus said to his disciples, namely that Jerusalem was going to be destroyed and the people of it dispersed and throughout the sea, the Gentile world. And this would come as a judgment to them. Now, the fact that Jesus would say, if you have faith, you can speak to it and this will happen, may seem strange to us because you might think, well, such a disaster as that wouldn't be something that Christians would want to happen. It wouldn't be something that Christians would pray for or believe in. And yet in Revelation chapter 6, we find prior to this mountain be thrown in the sea, in chapter 6 and verse 9 it says, he opened the fifth seal and I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they had held. Now, of course, Jesus said in Matthew 23 that it was Jerusalem that slew all the prophets and all the servants of God. So these are the martyrs, and the those who have killed them are no doubt Jerusalem, as Jesus said. Jesus said it cannot be that a prophet would die outside Jerusalem in Luke 13. And it says, and they cried with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell in the land? So here's the martyrs, the souls of the martyrs in heaven. And they're crying out to God and saying, how long, O Lord, will it be before you avenge our righteous blood that was shed on the land? Which is kind of interesting. Now, Jesus told a parable about this in Luke chapter 18. It says, he told a parable that men ought always to pray and not to faint. And it says, there was in a certain city, a judge who neither feared man nor God. And there was a widow in that city, and she came and saying, avenge me of my adversary. Now notice, this is the same thing that the martyrs in heaven are praying. They're saying, how long before you avenge our blood? Okay? And so this woman is saying to the judge, how long will you avenge me? Will you not avenge me of my adversary? Please avenge me. But he would not do it for a while. But afterward he said within himself, though I do not fear God or regard man, yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. Now, here's what Jesus says. Then the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge said. And, Jesus says, shall not God avenge his own elect who cry out day and night to him, though he bears long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith in the land? Now, here's the interesting thing. Jesus is not just talking about prayer in general. He's talking about prayer for vengeance. The widow is saying to the judge, avenge me of my adversary. And you know, that's not just, you know, the stage dressing of the parable. When he's done with the parable and he dresses the meaning of the parable, he says, God will avenge his elect who cry out to him day and night. Will not God avenge them? He will avenge them. Now, that's interesting because he sees the church as praying for God to avenge the righteous blood that was shed on the earth. And Jesus, as I said, made it very clear, all the righteous blood that was shed from Abel to Zechariah will come on Jerusalem, he said in Matthew 23. And he said it would happen in that generation. So really, the New Testament, including Jesus, depicts the church as having a role in carrying forward the purposes of God through prayer and through their faith. And that purpose of God includes, but is not restricted to, but includes the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And so when Jesus cursed the fig tree, representing Israel withering up, and he said to them, now you, if you have faith, can say to this mountain, be plucked up and thrown into the sea. I believe he's talking about the same subject. There seems no reason otherwise to say so. I mean, if he's simply saying me withering up this fig tree is a great example of what can be done with faith and nothing more, well, certainly Jesus did even more amazing miracles than that. He could have made that comment about. Instead, he is explaining, I think, in a cryptic way, as he often did, that Israel, the fig tree, or this mountain that they were ascending, Jerusalem, is going to be facing destruction. And the faith and the prayers of the disciples would be one of the means by which this would be brought about, just like the prayers of the saints in heaven do that. In Revelation 8, when we saw a mountain burning with fire thrown into the sea, this was because a few verses earlier, an angel in heaven had taken prayers of the saints, coals from the altar and incense, which are the prayers of the saints, and they ascended before God. And then he took coals from the altar and threw them on the land and brought about these disasters. In other words, these disasters came about from the same altar that the prayers were offered up from, showing an intentional connection between the prayers of the saints and the judgments that come. Now, many Christians might think it's not really a good idea for Christians to pray for judgment, but the destruction of Jerusalem was a necessary part of the church being vindicated and Jesus being vindicated. And that is that was part of God's plan going forward, and Christians were supposed to be praying for it.
Thank you for the explanation. I'll continue to do my research, and I appreciate your taking time out to thoroughly explain that. Grace, peace, and blessings, Stephen. God bless.
Same to you, Everett. God bless you. Thanks for your call. Okay, our next caller is Barbara from Snohomish, Washington. Barbara, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I was actually making a comment about the caller before, and he was talking about why Donald Trump, he felt, was being racist in what was going on with his birth certificate. And I think the reason he probably felt that was that Obama released, in the very beginning when the question came, he did release the long form in 2011. And so at that time, I could understand why people might have some questions. I think the reason there could be a suspicion of racism is that Mr. Trump continued from 2011 until 2016, continuing to tweet and to say some ideas that it was not correct. In fact, it was just recently in the last, 2 weeks that he admitted that he believed that Obama was born in the United States. Yet, in this whole time that he had believed a falsehood, evidently, he never apologized. And where that probably looks like racism is that for a president to have that sort of scrutiny and actually quite over-the-top scrutiny, especially since he released his birth certificate, would make one question, why was he targeted?
And well, would it be just as reasonable to suggest he was targeted because someone doesn't like his politics? I don't really see how there's any connection to race here. I mean, if Dr. Ben Carson, who is also a black man, had been elected to office, I don't think that Donald Trump or anyone else would be raising questions about where he was born. I don't even think people in the Ku Klux Klan would be raising questions about it, because that's not the way you exhibit racism. You don't exhibit racism by questioning where someone was born. Racism has to do not with where you were born, but what race you are. Now, Donald Trump, as far as I know, never raised an issue of Obama's race. He raised issues of where he was born. And frankly, let me just tell you this. I think Trump is a nut. Okay? I'm not defending Mr. Trump. Every time he opens his mouth, he totally embarrasses me. I'm not a defender of Trump in any way. I think he puts his foot in his mouth all the time. What I'm trying to appeal to is common sense. I'm not, you know, Trump may very well be a racist. I don't know him. He may be, he may not be. I've heard different reports. I don't even care if he's a racist because, I don't know, it doesn't have to impact this particular question. Because the issue here is not race, but geography. I think people who make everything about racism are the racists. I think they're the ones who make race the issue. At first, I wasn't sure when I first heard questions about whether Obama was born in America. I wasn't sure. I didn't know. I didn't have information. But it had nothing to do with what his race was. Now, I've always disliked his politics. And I dislike Hillary's just as much. And she's not even black. Because I don't care whether a person's black or white. In fact, I've never cared in my life whether a person was black or white. I'm not sure that Donald Trump does. Maybe he does. Maybe he's a racist. I don't know it. But the truth is that people who are raising objections to Obama are always accused of racism, when in fact the same people would be delighted if another man of the same race was in the office who had political views like theirs, which indicates that they're not so much concerned about what race he is as what his politics are. And I would assume, now I don't know if that's true with Mr. Trump because I don't know the man, but I would assume that most people who were raising questions about Obama's qualification for office, it had nothing to do with what race he is. Because, as I said, there have been a number of black men who were in primary elections before that I would have been very happy to see elected. I was not happy to see Obama elected because I don't agree with his philosophy.
Okay, so that is true. It could very well be that his color didn't. Or it could be a very underhanded and secretive way of getting the first black person discredited.
I think that's a silly suggestion. I think it's totally unwarranted. Obama is just as white as he is black. He's half black and half white. As far as I know, Ben Carson is all black. And, it seems like, you know, many Republicans would be delighted to have Ben Carson, who is 100% black, as a president. I would be delighted to have Ben Carson as a president. Mr. Obama is only half black. He's half the same race I am. He's half white. Who cares? I don't care if he's mixed race with 12 races mixed together in equal amounts. Who cares? Only racists care about that. And only racists accuse other people of being racist when they're not. When people raise an objection about a president who happens to be half black, and the objections are all political or all on some other subject than his race, and someone says, well, that's just an underhanded way of undermining him because he's black. Well, you know what? If Obama's politics were not so disgusting, if I liked his politics, I wouldn't hardly notice he was black. Who cares? I wouldn't, and most Republicans I know wouldn't. I'm not a Republican. I'm independent, but the truth is, I don't think most Republicans would object to him if his politics were more agreeable with theirs. It has nothing to do with race, and the people who think it does are the ones who are obsessed with race, which is what racists are. People who are not racists don't care about race. If I meet a man and he happens to be a black man, and I later talk about him to a friend of mine, I'm not going to be making an issue of this race because it's not significant. A man's race is not significant. His ideas are significant. His behavior is significant. His impact on society is significant. Now, again, this is not a defense of Mr. Trump. I can't think of very many things I can defend Mr. Trump about. I wish he would never open his mouth except with a teleprompter, because when he uses a teleprompter, he sounds reasonably okay. But whenever he talks on his own, it's awfully hard to keep the television on. But the point I'm making here is that the people who want to find racism where there isn't, themselves, they're giving too much away about themselves. They are racists. They make everything about race. And they make things about race that other people don't make about race. But because they are racist themselves, they project racism into everybody else. In fact, I suppose someone who's really a racist may not even believe that there are people who aren't racists. It's sort of like me, a person who's reasonably nice. I can't imagine that there's people who really like doing cruel things to people. It's really hard for me to imagine. There really are cruel people out there. It's just so foreign to me to be cruel. And yet, there are cruel people out there. I think that there's someone who's in, you know, innately racist person. They have a hard time believing there's anyone out there who isn't a racist. They might resent people who say they're not racist because they think they're hiding or trying to hide something. And then they go looking for hidden meanings in things that someone else says. They say, there it is. It's coming out. This is a very subtle way of trying to convince the naive populace that this man of another race is unqualified, even though they're not mentioning his race. I think I grew up in an age where people didn't talk about race all the time, and most of us, at least I and people I knew, never cared at all whether a man was a Mexican or a black man or a Asian or whatever. It's just not an issue. But I think it's the liberal politicians that are making everything about race. And I think as you look at their own private practices, in many cases, you find that they themselves are racist. I mean, remember, it was Bill Clinton. And I don't know why this isn't held against him, but Bill Clinton, when Obama was first running for office, he joked with another liberal politician. He said, you know, there was a time when this guy would have been getting our coffee for us. You know, now that sounds like a racist statement to me. And it is, because Clinton is no doubt a racist. I mean, a man who would make statements like that no doubt is. But a man who says, I don't know where such and such a person is born, and has no reference to his race whatsoever, I don't see how that's called racist. Anyway, we've gone over this enough times, but I'll let you have the last word.
I hear what you're saying, and I think it's because for 5 years he carried on a deliberate thing to put doubt in people's mind. And so
okay, I'm afraid that's not – I can't give you the last word because you're just saying something that I've already answered. If Donald Trump to this day was denying that Mr. Obama was born in America, this would still be absolutely nothing about racism. At least if it is about racism, it's not evidently so. There's nothing evidently about raising questions about the location of someone's birth that can be tied to race. I think what people are assuming is white people are racist. Trump is a white person. He said something negative about Obama. Obama has some black in him, and therefore probably, even though there's no mention of his blackness, no mention of his race, probably there's racism behind that remark. As I said, I'm very strongly convinced that the people who think that way are the racists. To them, everything's about race. To me, nothing is about race. To God, nothing is about race. God values all people the same, and I think there's a lot of liberals out there that don't. And that's frankly, I think, why they like to talk about racism all the time. They're obsessed with it because it's them. Anyway, now you got me talking about politics, Mark, from up in Washington there. And he didn't think I should. Anyway, I'd like to stick with, the Bible. But once in a while, frankly, I let people talk about what they want to talk about. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. Go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. You'll see how you can help donate to keep us on the air if you're interested. That's thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.